First of all, I should tell you who I am, in case you don't know. My name is David Greisel, and I serve on the elder team at Christ Community Church. And about once a year now, they let me come in and do this one talk in Racers 2 about beauty and creativity because I'm an architect. Obviously not because I'm beautiful, but because I work as an architect, and so beauty and creativity is kind of what I try to do every day. So why don't we begin with a word of prayer? Let's pray. Father, thank you for this evening, and thank you for everyone that could be here tonight. Thank you that the roads are clearer today. And Lord, I thank you for this time together to just contemplate the beauty of your world and your incredible creativity and creative expression. Father, I pray you'd overlook the sin of him who teaches and just help us to be taught by your Holy Spirit tonight. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So this, you know, in the context of where we've been and where we're going, one way to think of it is these last three sessions on evangelism and on creativity and on justice and mercy are all kind of tangible expressions of how the church works itself out in the wider world. So that's kind of a little bit of context. But let's talk about the big A word for a second here. What comes into your mind when somebody says art? What do you think about? What's the first thought that pops into your head? Mona Lisa. Good. Painting. Nelson Atkins. Museum. Right. What else comes into your mind? All things creative, such as all the different media, such as music. Film? The skyline of Chicago. That's an interesting thing. What? Theater. Yeah, theater. Right. So, and, you know, lots of creative media out there. And, you know, art sometimes gets conflated with another word, culture. And sometimes when you think of art and culture, you think of media, specific media like painting, sculpture, film, music, writing. There's all kinds of things you could think of. But I also want you to think of art as including a whole lot more than the sort of high culture media that you might think of. I always like to think of art including things like cooking, spreadsheets, doing math, healing, the healing arts, you know, Ars Medica. There's all kinds of things qualify as art. So don't limit yourself to just thinking about painting and sculpture or music and dance, because there's many, many things that qualify as art and creative expression. So it's not just a matter of, we're not just talking about high culture here, although we will probably talk more about the sort of traditional arts this evening than we will talk about spreadsheets. But just to be aware of that, art includes lots of things. When you think about Christian engagement with the arts, what comes into your head? What kinds of ways has the church in the last 10 or 20 years interacted with the arts? Pardon me? Okay, there's kind of so one way that the church has interacted with the arts has been to create its own little subculture. So Christian film industry was mentioned. And in fact, there's a Christian everything industry, right? There's a Christian book industry, there's a Christian magazine industry, there's a Christian film industry, there's a Christian music industry. Every cultural expression you can think of has its counterpart in the Christian subculture. So that's one way that the church interacts with culture, is by creating its own little subculture. What's another way that the church interacts with culture? Yes?
Just that some of these parts were bad and do away with.
Yeah, so So another way that the church interacts with culture is what Andy Crouch calls the posture of critique. Which turns out to be a little less useful than we might think. Everybody, I mean, art criticism is a helpful thing, but it turns out that being constantly in a critical mode tends to devalue your input. So the Christian world constantly being in a state of critique against the arts, you know, always saying this is bad, this is unhealthy, while sometimes necessary, turns out to be maybe a little less helpful than we would think. Any other ways that you can think of that the church has typically engaged with the arts? How about in the past? Now dial it back 500 years, not 20 years. How did the church interact with the arts 500 years ago?
Mission.
Patronage. So in the more distant past, and much less so today, the church was the major patron of the arts. In fact, if you go back to, you know, the Renaissance or periods, you know, like that, hundreds of years ago, the church was really the primary patron of the arts. The church and basically royalty or nobility, they were the primary patrons of art. And when you go to see paintings in museums that are 500 years old, invariably they were either commissioned by some rich person or by some religious organization. In fact, you know, when I studied the history of architecture, it was really funny because for like, you know, we started 6,000 years ago with the first, you know, ziggurats or whatever they were, and from 6,000 years ago until right up until literally yesterday, in this case yesterday was about 1850, church architecture and architecture were one and the same. That's all we talked about in architecture history class was religious architecture up until about 1850. And then about 1850, there started being all these other buildings that were not religious buildings that became interesting buildings. And nowadays, it's kind of almost flipped to where religious architecture isn't even a topic of modern architectural discussion. It's much more about art museums and the symphony halls and things like that. So it's really kind of odd how that's changed. But yeah, so long time ago, much more about patronage. More recently, it's more about critique and subculture. So let's flip a couple slides. Yeah, so there's one guy's idea of the new creation, kind of a literal interpretation of Revelation 21. You see the 12 different stones that are the foundations of the New Jerusalem, which is represented as a golden cube. I'm not quite sure this is where we ought to be headed, but it's interesting. Let's go to the next slide. So I wanted to show you this. Some of you are old enough to remember this movie when it came out. Many of you probably are not, but in 1988, Martin Scorsese made a film called The Last Temptation of Christ. What was the reaction of the church to this film? It was more than negative. It was violent protest. It was, you know, we were out there picketing the exhibition of this film. The ironic thing, I haven't actually ever seen it, but the ironic thing is that Martin Scorsese, of all the famous Hollywood directors, he is probably the one that is most closely identified with Christianity in terms of actually having a faith that he's willing to talk about. But we were out there with our picket signs saying, boo, hiss, don't go see this movie. And that was kind of, you know, that's the critique part of the church's response to that film. So why should Christians care about art? Well, because God cares about art. How do we know that God cares about art? Well, it's very evident if you read the first couple chapters of Genesis that God is very interested in creativity and self-expression, is it not? What he was doing when he created the universe and everything in the universe was a form of self-expression. The universe is not God, but it expresses God. It expresses his divine nature, his personality, his interests. And, you know, the more we look into the universe through the wonderful gifts of things like the Hubble telescope, the more we are just overwhelmed by the beauty of it, which shouldn't really surprise us as believers, should it? Because it was created by a very beautiful God. And in the creation story, God created Adam and Eve as image bearers and co-regents, and we are to, in the way that God commissioned Adam and Eve, he expects them to cultivate and subdue, and we get the idea of culture from this idea of cultivation, that part of Adam's and Eve's commission was to actually create something with the raw materials that God had given them. And so that's part of the creation mandate. We'll talk about that in a sec. Here's a quote from N.T. Wright in the book Surprised by Hope. To make sense of and celebrate a beautiful world through the production of artifacts that are themselves beautiful is part of the call to be stewards of creation, as was Adam's naming of the animals. Genuine art is thus itself a response to the beauty of creation, which itself is a pointer to the beauty of God. Do you get that? Genuine art is a response to the beauty of creation. It doesn't necessarily mean it's just a picture of it, but it's a response to it, which is itself a pointer to the beauty of God. And so why have Christians often or largely withdrawn from the world of the arts, particularly in the modern era that we live in? One reason is this Cartesian dualism, which has been so rampant in the church in the last 150 years ago, which is this, you know, the idea that there's a spiritual realm and then there's a physical realm, and that everything that we should care about is up here in the spiritual realm, and we shouldn't spend any time at all worrying about the physical realm because it doesn't matter because it's not spiritual. We very much advocate against that kind of dualistic thinking here at Christ Community, and I hope this strikes you as a kind of unfortunate paradox, but the fact of the matter is this is where a lot of the church has been for the last 150 years, has been out in the business of trying to save souls, and not that there's anything wrong with saving souls, but at the expense of everything else in the universe just being shoved aside, including arts and culture. So that's one of the problems. The church has thought of art as impractical, the same way that a lot of small-town school boards think of art as impractical. What good is it? What use is it? What does it do for you? Can you get a job doing art? Does it pay well? Does it help train our workforce for the 21st century? All those questions of practical application kind of miss a really big point, which is that while art itself may not, in fact, do anything in the sense of, like, you know, a car or a refrigerator does something, it actually does something much more important, which is it frames discussions. Anybody here ever see the movie Cider House Rules? You remember that movie? It was one of the most persuasive, compelling, pro-abortion rants I've ever come across. And the thing that was so sneaky about it was it didn't say, come see this movie about abortion and why it's such a great thing. It said, come see this movie about this, you know, heartwarming story of a young doctor and an orphanage and blah, blah, blah. You know, the whole abortion message was loaded into it. My point is that the Cider House Rules, the movie, didn't do anything like a car or refrigerator except reframe the whole discussion around abortion, right? So art is sneaky that way. It doesn't do anything, but it does a lot. And by walking away from it, the church has missed out on a lot of opportunity to enter into that discussion. The other reason that the church has kind of tended to shy away from art in recent years is because we tend to view art as debased because of so many expressions of art which are debased. We have a tendency to sort of throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. And so since there's, you know, an artist who, you know, let's say is, you know, doing homoerotic photographs, we think, well, okay, that guy's bad, so all of his art must be bad, so all photography must be bad, so I'm not going to go to museums anymore. This is kind of cascading train of non-logic that takes you entirely out of the picture. There is art that's debased, and we should be willing to call it that, but at the same time, as I said before, If our only posture is a posture of critique, we're not going to be able to effectively engage the world of the arts. So we have to be careful about that. We have to be careful about calling things out as debased. Not that we should never do it, but we need to be judicious about when we do it so that we don't become the scolds of modern culture, which is how a lot of people see the church right now. So for these and other reasons, as we said, you know, the evangelical church has kind of built their own parallel empire, the subculture part of the discussion, with their own books and music and movies. And unfortunately, if you think about cultural influence, this Christian subculture of books, movies, paintings, music, whatever, has almost zero influence on the wider culture. We're really just talking to ourselves, and that's the unfortunate thing. Now, every once in a while, you'll have a crossover artist like Amy Grant that can go from Christian recording artist to mainstream recording artist, but the fact that that happens so rarely is kind of evidence of the fact that we're really in a little echo chamber in our Christian art subculture. So, again, not trying to throw rocks and say that that's a bad thing to do, but it's in terms of the wider cultural conversation, it's not very effective. And a recent Barna study showed that a year of research shows that the leading influencers of American society are movies, television, the internet, books, and music. I think probably music would be higher on that list, but anyway, the Christian church, Barna says, is not among the top dozen influences these days. So that, you know, suggests to you that we've kind of abdicated our position of cultural influence. Francis Schaeffer said, "Art and media are the means and bridge over which the current philosophers reach the general culture. Whoever controls the media controls the culture." Another quote that I like is actually from a very unusual source, Fidel Castro. Said one of his mottos was capture the transmitters. And what he meant by that was, if, you know, when he was in the process of revolutionizing Cuba, if he could capture the radio stations, he could control the media and control the conversation. So the church, you know, I think has not only not captured the transmitters, but in a lot of ways we've run away from the transmitters in the last 100 years or so. So let's explore for a few minutes, a biblical theology of imagination, beauty, and creativity. And we're going to do it through the context of our good old four-chapter story. So let's start with chapter 1. So let's go ahead to the next slide. Chapter 1, the creation, the what ought to be. So we see in Genesis 1 and 2, no big surprise here, that God creates the universe out of nothing, that God declares what he creates to be good and celebrates his creative work every day. Do you celebrate your creative work every day? Do you get home at the end of the day and say, that was good? I don't. I should, but I don't. But that's what God did. At the end of every day, he said, that was good. Genesis 2:9 is helpful in this regard. Let's look at Genesis 2:9 real quickly. Because this is really interesting. This is during the creation account. And the Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. So what you see in Genesis 2:9, just in that one little snippet, you see something really interesting. You see beauty coupled with, that's my coupled with, utility. And so often in our culture, especially America, we get over-focused on utility and miss the point about beauty. But when God created the trees in Genesis 2:9, it says they were pleasing to the eye and good for food. Now, it doesn't say they were just pleasing to the eye, and it doesn't say they were just good for food. It says they were both. So beauty and utility should be, in the ought version of our world, the what should be married together always. Things should be both beautiful and useful. And, you know, I'm sure you can think of many things that are useful but not beautiful, which suggests to the degree to maybe which we have fallen short of God's ideal in that regard. We still experience the beauty of creation today. You know, everybody does. There was a beautiful sunset this evening. I don't know if you haven't had a chance to see it, but it was, you know, walking through the forest. And that beauty does remind us of this beauty, the beauty of the garden, which sadly is lost to us now. So that takes us to chapter 2, the fall into sin, the is part. And through the fall, like with everything else, imagination and creativity were corrupted and became self-serving. Ugliness entered the world, which is still reflected in many respects in our broader cultural understanding of beauty. In fact, we're kind of in an odd place now culturally where beauty isn't even often a category that you can get serious art people to talk about, which is a really odd thing. But our culture has moved so far over beyond God narrative that it's hard to get art curators and museum directors to even talk about beauty because they think our culture is so far gone that it's just not even worth discussing, which is really odd. Does this mean that we should retreat from the art world? I don't think so. But some would argue that art, to be true and honest, has to include the fall. Now, what do you think about that? In other words, let's flip back one a sec. Okay, so here's the painting, Wenzel Peters' painting of the Garden of Eden from 1820. Just real quickly, what does this make you think of? Anybody here getting Thomas Kincaid? Okay, now let's go to the fall. This is Michelangelo's The Fall of Man and the Expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Certainly doesn't make you think of a Thomas Kincaid painting, does it? So the question is there a sense in which art has to be honest about depicting the fall in order to be honest art? What do you think? Meh. I'm getting meh. Anybody got an opinion about that? Yeah. I got a yes. Yes, art needs to depict the fall in order to be honest art. Because why?
They made it look like something pretty or goofy or something.
Yeah, okay. So realism requires that we be honest about our fallen condition. And we want art to be truthful, so in order to be truthful, it has to be somewhat realistic about our fallen condition. Does that mean art can't be redemptive? No, doesn't mean that, but it does mean that it has to be at least somewhat realistic about the fallen nature of humanity. Go, Mary.
Because realism is a period of that was emphasized, or well, it manifests itself in literature and fine art, et cetera, et cetera. But prior to that, it was the ideal. I mean, if you look at the Greek art, it was just the beautiful ideal of the human body. And that is as close to Eden as I can think of, celebrating the beauty of God's creation. Perfection, that was the rule.
Okay. Okay, so Mary says realism was just a phase that we went through and that that there were many other phases, including phases that were focused on ideal versus the real, which is true. So what do you think about that? Not sure where to go with that. Yeah, it was a thing. And should art... Okay, so here's art down here. Should art point us toward the ideal, or should it point us toward the real? Yes. Maybe what art should do is, maybe art should point us toward the four-chapter story, which actually is a great outline for any book, play, or movie, is, creation, fall, redemption, new creation. That kind of encompasses both the ideal and the real, doesn't it? So that would be one way of answering that question. It's, you know, I'm not sure there is a right answer to that question. It's certainly something that's been debated over and over again. And realism tends to come and go as a form in many forms of artistic expression. It has its ups and downs. Okay, so we were in chapter 2. Let's jump ahead to chapter 3, redemption. So how do we understand the world of art and creativity in terms of redemption? Well, first of all, I would invite you to look toward the Bible itself as a piece, definitely the preeminent piece of redemptive art in all of human history. And why do I say that? Well, because the Bible is full of incredible artistic imagery. Now, it's a work of literature, primarily. The Bible doesn't come with pictures, unless the pictures were added by somebody else. But as a work of literature, it includes every kind, every genre of great literature that there is, including poetry and songs, right? It is dramatic in its use of historical narrative to tell stories. There is dance that is referenced in the Psalms, 149 and 150. So we see in the Bible itself the idea of the whole story of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation is a story of redemption and is redemptive in itself, but also there's many a little subgenres along the way. The Bible's full of songs. You ever thought about that? The Song of Moses, Song of Miriam, Song of Mary, and all of the Psalms, which were originally designed to be sung, although we, you know, mostly just read them nowadays. So the Bible is an incredible work of redemptive literature all by itself. Also, I want to point out to you that the Bible refers to the spiritual empowerment of artists. And I want to particularly direct your attention to my favorite chapter in all of the Bible, Exodus chapter 31, which if you have a Bible, I'd encourage you to turn there with me. I'm going to read a few verses for you. Exodus chapter 31, then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have chosen Bezalel, son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with skill, ability, and knowledge in all kinds of crafts, to make artistic designs for work in gold, silver, and bronze, to cut and set stones, to work in wood, and to engage in all kinds of craftsmanship." And it goes on from there. And to me, this is one of the most extraordinary passages in all the Bible, for obvious reasons, because I'm an architect, for one, but secondly, because how many of you have ever done one of those spiritual gift inventory things, one of those little quiz things that tries to identify what your spiritual gifts are? Was design on the list? No. Design was not on the list. Those spiritual gift inventories get all their inventory from Corinthians, which has, you know, it has this long list of, you know, works, helps, administration, healing, teaching, prophecy, you know, da 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 da. It doesn't even mention creative design, because that was back here in Exodus chapter 31, where the spiritual gifts people just missed it. But very clearly it says here, the Lord says to Moses, "I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with skill, ability, and knowledge in all kinds of crafts." It doesn't get much plainer than that. So that was a real breakthrough for me to realize that God does, in fact, inspire people, fills him with his Spirit to engage in creative design. And it should be an inspiration to anyone who works in any creative field, which, as I said at the outset, can include spreadsheets and recipes just as much as it can include painting and sculpture. So art is a powerful tool to help us picture what can and will be. And hopefully, I would think that to the degree that you are involved in the arts, it would be pointed in a redemptive direction. But as we said, there's lots of different ways that can be expressed. And we can bring beauty to a world that is often quite ugly. But, you know, what I hope we don't do is bring ugliness to a world that's often quite beautiful. So, Christians ought to be the most creative people. Most of Western history is about Christian creativity. It's only really been in the last couple hundred years that we've sort of walked away from that legacy that we have. Chapter 4, the new creation. This is probably the hardest one to talk about from an art perspective. Let's go to Revelation chapter 21. And I think we have, this is a really interesting painting by Goya. I wish you could see it better. But what do you suppose that big triangle in the middle represents? What? Trinity, yeah, I think that's probably a good guess. Let's go to Revelation chapter 21. And, you know, the book of Revelation is full of imagery and, frankly, hard to understand in a lot of respects. But this part is really not that hard to understand. The New Jerusalem, chapter 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. There was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God." So on and so forth. I'm going to skip ahead. Skipping ahead. Okay. Showed me the holy city. I'm down to verse 10 now. Showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates and with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And it goes on, tells about the, you know, the 12 foundations. And then in chapter 22, the river of life. The angel showed me the river of the water of life as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and from the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Now, I'm not going to try to unpack all that symbolism for you tonight because we'd be here all night, but it's a beautiful, extraordinary, imaginative picture of the new creation. I think the challenge with chapter 4 from an artistic perspective is just really hard to get our heads around how beautiful that ultimate consummation is going to be. In fact, I think the word consummation is interesting. That's one of the ways that we talk about the fourth chapter is we use the term consummation because I think that there are, you know, very definitely sexual overtones to that, and I think in a way it sort of points to the beauty of the new creation. It's like it's that good. In fact, it's even better than that. But it's hard for us to wrap our heads around it, and I get that. I want to share with you my very favorite poem, which I always do. It's called "When Earth's Last Picture is Painted," and it's by Rudyard Kipling. And this, I think, is a wonderful picture of the new creation. And, you know, he wasn't maybe as well-versed in the four-chapter story as we are, but I think he gets it really right here. So this is Rudyard Kipling. "When Earth's last picture is painted and the tubes are twisted and dried, when the oldest colors have faded and the youngest critic has died, we shall rest, and faith we shall need it, lie down for an eon or two, till the master of all good workmen shall put us to work anew. And those that were good shall be happy. They'll sit in a golden chair. They'll splash at a 10-league canvas with brushes of comet's hair. They'll find real saints to draw from, Magdalene, Peter, and Paul. They'll work for an age that is sitting and never be tired at all. And only the master shall praise us, and only the master shall blame. And no one will work for the money, and no one will work for the fame, but each for the joy of the working, and each in his separate star will draw the thing as he sees it, for the God of things as they are." I just love that. Sorry. So, chapter 4. All right, we're going to wrap this up. If I can get my place. Yeah, okay. So now let's talk about local church engagement. And I want to brainstorm for you, with you for a minute. So, two things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about how the local church does and should engage with the arts, and then we're going to talk about how the individual church member does and should engage with the arts. Wow. Okay, so brainstorm with me for a sec here. Let's first talk about the local church. Local church. And let's talk about engagement in terms of does well, could do better. Okay, so, and because we're pretty much all Christ Community people here, let's just talk about local church in the context of Christ Community. So, when Christ Community engages with the arts, what does it do well? Yes?
Well, I remember back at the Plaza Art Fair Culture Center. Culture House had brought in this dance
class. Yeah, Culture House did this big, okay, so.
They had all the stage, and they were doing dances. Christian music.
Partners with Culture House, so that's a good thing. What else does our local church do to engage with the arts? What do we do well? I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you. What? Okay, so we get the word out. So that's a good thing. Okay, so we have four chapter art right on the back of the sanctuary wall. What else do we do well? Yeah, I think we do music pretty well. And it's interesting now that we're a multi-site campus that we actually kind of have different flavors of music at our different campuses, which I think is really kind of cool. What else do we do well? Yeah, you know, our church is really good at graphic design. I think probably one of the best I've seen outside of New York City. We really get the graphics thing really well. What are some things we could do better? Anything? We're perfect? It's all on the good side. I'd just like to see, personally, I'd like to see more art. I think our halls are still a little sparse in that regard. What else? Anything on the do better side? Patronage. We could certainly, you know, that's sort of one of those how high is the sky questions. But yeah, we could certainly do more of that. What else? Yeah, you know, we have from time to time had dance performances in worship, and I think those have been pretty well received, but it's not something we do a lot of for a variety of reasons, but certainly could do more of it. Yeah, anything else?
The first study we ever did here, there were four people that stood up and read the scripture in four different languages.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, and we do kind of dabble in drama, but it's not something that is really deeply embedded in our worship practice. It's something that's kind of a here and there thing. Anything else on the could do better? Yeah.
We haven't been here long enough to know, perhaps it's been in high school, but for children and for the children's program, how much exposure do kids get to that other than commotion, which is limited to the small group now?
Mm-hmm.
Engaged in that really every other Sunday.
Okay, so good. I'll add one more to the does well list. We're actually pretty active at sponsorships, oddly enough. I can remember just recently, well, not that recently, but on Labor Day, I was Is it Labor Day? Memorial Day. Memorial Day. I was at the Symphony at the Station concert, that thing that they do in front of Union Station where there's 50,000 people. And they've got this jumbo. It's really funny. They got this jumbotron that the only thing on the jumbotron is sponsors. They don't use it to televise anything. But but there we were. We were on the jumbotron, which I thought was really cool. That was a proud moment for me as a Christ Community member. So that's one of our due things. So the point is, there's things we do well. There's things we could do better. But the local church does need to engage with and support art if we want to be part of the conversation, right? Because if we don't, we're not part of the conversation. And I say that, you know, regardless of whether it's on the does well or could do better list, just the fact that we're having this conversation is a healthy thing. Because there's a lot of churches that just don't. They're still back in the sacred secular dichotomy, trying to save souls and forget about art, which I think is actually not a very good strategy. Okay, let's talk about individual engagement. How do you as an individual engage with the arts? And remember, we started off talking about how the Christian church has typically gone one of two ways primarily, either into the Christian subculture or into a posture of critique. So let's talk about alternatives to subculture or critique. What are some alternatives? What are some ways that you as individual church members and Christians and believers can engage with the arts? Wow, Dan. That's an awesome idea. Let's go to 2CG 2013 at CCC Brookside. Registration is available on the web. April 4th, no, 5 and 6. Coming up soon, yeah. Good idea, Dan. Man, talk about a plug. All right, how else can we engage with the arts? Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right, Stephen. Let me tell you about the greatest thing in the world, which is, unfortunately, I think not being done this year, but the greatest thing in the world was Friends of Chamber Music used to have this program called What Makes It Great, where this guy from New York named Rob Capello would come and explain classical music to us, and it was the greatest thing in the world because you not only got to hear great classical music, you got to have a guy go through and explain bar by bar by bar what was so great about it, and it was just awesome. And that kind of stuff still exists, although I don't think Capello's coming to town this year. But just to point out, if you live in Johnson County like I do, you get this stuff in the mail all the time. And for most of you, it probably goes right in the recycling bin. But the Nelson Gallery sends out every month Explore Art. You don't even have to be a member to get this publication. And it tells you about all the awesome stuff that's going on at the Nelson Gallery and all these awesome lectures that they have every month of the world to explain the art to you. So if you don't understand something, there's no excuse. It's because it's all right here, and most of it's free, or a lot of it's free. Also, the Kansas City Public Library is absolutely amazing in terms of the programming that they do. 99% of it is free. They have... And it's not just all about books. It's about movies, and it's about culture, and it's about history. And they have dramatic presentations. They have free readings of stage plays that don't get produced very often because they're not commercially popular, but they're great plays. This stuff goes on at the library all the time. All you got to do is get on their mailing list, and you'll get this publication every month as well. I mean, literally, there's stuff going on every night of the week at the library. It's incredible the amount of programming that they do, and there's no excuse for us to not be part of it. So, education, as Steve said, and I'm just going to say, because this is where I thought Dan was going until it turned into a shameless plug for CG 2013, go to stuff. Okay, there's just a wealth of stuff to go to. Some of it's expensive, some of it's not. Give you an example. Saturday night, Kansas City Civic Orchestra is playing at Atonement Lutheran Church. The Civic Orchestra is a volunteer orchestra. They don't get paid. They're very good, and it's totally free. So money is not the problem here. The problem is your willingness to get up and do something outside of the house. So go to stuff. What else? Well, there you go. Good for them. So you can go to the downtown library and not only get a book, but experience great architecture at the same time. How cool is that? What else? What else can we do to engage with the arts as individuals, Christians, and believers? Dan, is this another shameless plug? Yeah. Yes, I'm going to give you Greisel's Law of Exercise here, which is something is better than nothing. That is Greisel's Law of Exercise. So if you only have time to work out 5 minutes a day, work out 5 minutes a day. If you only have time to go to one art museum a year, go to one art museum a year. Something is better than nothing. So, and doing one thing is better than doing no thing. So good job. What else? How else can we engage with the arts? Anything? What? Support an artist, yes. Patronage. So here's the thing. Patronage. If you ask most artists, would you rather I write a check or buy a ticket? Most of them would say, I'd rather you buy a ticket than write a check. Now, obviously, they do depend to some degree on the largesse of benefactors to underwrite their productions, but for the vast majority of us, buying a ticket is a better form of patronage than writing a check. Why is that? What? Well, it's not so much that they feel beholden to you, but it's that you're actually engaging with them in their art. Okay, if I write a check for $5,000 to Culture House, go, here you go, Jeremiah, here's $5,000, have a nice day. Did I engage? What? Well, he will take it. He'll cash the check.
And here's why. Because patronage, I think that's a great term. It's not write a check. You are engaged when you become a patron. You see whatever it is that you're doing is of great value. And probably you like it as well. But I think, yeah.
Or you might even get a free ticket if you wrote a $5,000 check. But my point is, if you just write the check and you don't go to whatever Culture House is doing, you haven't really engaged with Culture House, have you? You've supported them financially, but you haven't really engaged. I would suggest to you that for the vast majority of us who aren't rich, and I would certainly be in that category, buying a ticket and attending something, again, whether it's an exhibition or a dance or performance or theater or a movie or whatever it is of more value potentially, at least to us, than it is to write them a big fat check. But that's not to say you shouldn't write big fat checks if you have that capability. That's great. So what else? How else can we engage with the arts? We're down to the last minute. Yes?
I was just thinking on mission trips, you can give permission trips, but if you ever go on one, you can kind of put those two, you know, attending a, you know, being involved and just giving to missions versus going on a mission.
I'm not sure I'm tracking with you here. Going on a mission trip and.
Well, being involved in missions, I know that's maybe a little bit far off topic of
Not at all. Not at all.
You know, it's... going on and engaging in a mission.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, so good. So that's an excellent suggestion. Get out. Get outside the ghetto. And I don't mean the ghetto, I mean art Christian ghetto, right? Get outside the ghetto, engage with the arts in the wider world. So, and again, no knock on Culture House, because I love Culture House, but go to somebody else's dance program, right? Because there are other good dance companies in town. It's not Culture House, Storling is not the only one. So yeah, get outside the ghetto.
But Dave, where do we put in, because I think if we looked at, I mean, most people at Christ Community, how many movies do we attend? I mean, we probably visit AMC Theater more than we visit any of these.
Yeah, movies are a vastly popular form of cultural engagement. Okay, so I'm gonna suggest to you, with respect to movies, because movies is something we all do a lot of, be discerning. Read reviews, and I don't want to say don't go see the Avengers, because it's not wrong to go see the Avengers, but make room in your life for some really good movies. Go look in the paper, the ones that get 4 stars, try to figure out, why did this movie get 4 stars, and why is it playing at the Tivoli for 12 people on a Friday night? Okay? Be discerning. And so learn about what makes great movies great. We're out of time. Thank you very much for your wonderful participation tonight. Have a great rest of the evening.